Your Steve Jones Show podcast is loading now. The Steve Jones Show podcast is sponsored by Sunbury Motors, North 4th Street in Sunbury, and Sunbury Motors Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. Sports talk where your voice counts. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now, from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Kia, routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. A couple times this week we've discussed John Beilein interviewing with the Detroit Pistons. John did say today that he's going to stay with Michigan. So he is staying with Michigan to be their basketball coach. Time now for the play-by-play call of the day. Old friend Terry Smith, the former voice of Ohio State football, now calling the Angels games.
There goes the runner at first. The pitch is a strike. Now the Angels have the runner caught in the rundown, but already scoring for the Angels will be Chris Young. So the inning will end on that play right there. But Young crossed the plate before they got the rundown completed.
And that was the only run of the game. That was it. All right. So John Beilein staying at Michigan. Sean is safely back intact. And the graph on media sales stayed the same today. So it's all...
status quo kind of day.
It's all falling into... Yeah, but status quo in that department happens every day.
Yeah.
Which is, we're waiting for the graph, the line in the graph, to make a move.
Yeah, we want it to bend upwards, to the right.
Oh, boy, this is where you... It reminds me of the great 60s musical Man of La Mancha. Remember what the theme song from that was? To dream the impossible dream.
That's right.
All right.
Yeah, you like a good theater show from time to time.
Absolutely.
Sure.
Oh, absolutely. Man of La Mancha, the impossible dream. You know, it's like the graph on the media sales department. To right the unrightable wrong.
Is that the one with Don Quixote? Maybe not.
No.
The sidekick, Sancho Panza? Oh, wrong play.
No,
sorry.
No.
Oh, well.
No. This is Sidekick the Chief.
All right. Sancho Chief Panza.
Ah, boy, Craig the Chief and I had such a good time at the golf tournament, didn't we?
You 1 month ago. Too. Oh, it's hard to believe it's been a month already.
Matt Cottrell, man, I'll tell you, five of us had a good time.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else about that day.
I haven't heard anything new from the Purdy team, whether if Adam is available for our team for next year, you know, a la, you know, Vegas expansion draft, you know, fleecing the castaways, you know.
I should talk to Jack about getting Jack to come in. I probably should do that. I can tell you right now he's going to get cut right away. All right, so.
We got to beat these guys.
Like what Elvis Presley and Viva Las Vegas. Gotta win this race. Okay, in this scene, Elvis sings.
Just to get Hammer's reaction when you point to, you know, Jack, you see that bridge over there?
Okay. Not once, but twice, and almost a third time. He missed that bridge by what, 6-9 inches this time?
Very close.
Now, for any of you who have played at the Susquehanna Valley Country Club, okay, it's the, what, sixth hole up the hill? No, it's the fifth hole up the hill. And the bridge is to the left. Now, maybe if we wouldn't point ourselves in that direction.
Right.
No comment.
Yeah.
All right. What's fun of this time of the year is we get to bring Steve Bordstein on, because I always have a lot of fun talking with him about horse racing, and we just have a good time. My friend, great to have you back.
Wow. I if I'm responsible for your happiness, I don't, that's a bad sign for me, I think, my friend. That's that says more about me, I think.
Just said it made it more fun.
All right.
Okay, Justify gets the rail. It's one time around. The track is exactly a mile and a half. So starting on the rail means to you what?
Nothing. If he can't work out a perfect trip for 12 furlong race, then the rail's the least of his problems. I mean, no, the rail's not an issue. In a mile and a half race like this, the only thing that'll bother him a little bit is if, you know, a horse comes over on top of him, because then he's got nowhere to go. But I'm not concerned about that in any way. The rail position is the least of his issues.
Least of his issues, which means you think there are issues involved. What are the issues?
Well, the issues could be, ironically enough, a dry track. I mean, that's the his last two races, both the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness, were run on sloppy tracks. I don't know if he's not better on a sloppy track. Certainly his two best speed figures, if you go by speed figures, came on dry tracks. So it really depends on what kind of track he's going to get on Belmont Day, because right now there is a chance of rain in the forecast. When that rain arrives on Saturday afternoon and how much of an impact that'll have on the actual racetrack still remains to be seen. The race is scheduled for 6:45 Eastern time, so unless it's a deluge on Saturday afternoon, I don't imagine it'll have that much of an impact on the racetrack itself, but it could, and that obviously could be a factor if his two races are to be believed. He did slow down a little bit in the Preakness Stakes in his most recent start. The number didn't come back great on that race. If he's better on a dry track, then I think it's lights out, but he hasn't been beaten yet so far on either a dry track or a wet track.
You know, when you look at the track records of all the horses in the race at a mile and a half, oh, that's right, there aren't any. How unpredictable is it, because no one has ever had to go this distance among this group of horses?
And that's the beauty of it. That's why it's the hardest race to win. That's why they call it the test of champions, because none of these horses have gone that far. You've got Gronkowski, who's never been a step beyond a mile in his racing career, in his six race career. You've got a couple of horses who the furthest they've ever gone is a mile and an eighth. So to give your listeners kind of an idea, it's three extra blocks. Imagine a city block, three extra blocks. That's for a lot of horses who haven't gone beyond a mile and an eighth before. So it's that difficult. It really is. And I mean, you can't underscore, and you mentioned, you know, the track itself, it's one time around. That stretch run looks like about the distance between here and Mars. I mean, it is really that long. And if you want to get an idea, one of my favorite moments is to watch 1998, when Real Quiet had a chance to win the Triple Crown. Kent DeSorma was riding him that afternoon, ironically, for Bob Baffert, and he opens up on the far turn. He opens up what looks like an insurmountable lead.
Yes.
And then Kent DeSorma realizes how long that stretch is, and here comes Victory Gallop, trained by Elliot Walden, on the far outside and nails him in the very last jump. That's how severely long that stretch run is. So it's really about timing. It's really about, you know, having the right momentum going into the top of the stretch.
Well, Smarty Jones, a nose at the end.
Right.
I mean,
Smarty Jones, exactly. It's a great example.
If that race is 10 yards shorter, he wins.
Exactly. And it goes back also to one of my favorite runnings of the Belmont Stakes is 2005, a filly by the name of Rags to Riches, who not only had to go the mile and a half, no filly had ever won the Belmont in over 100 years. Not only does she have to win the race, beating the eventual Horse of the Year, Curlin, she has to do it going four wide every step of the way.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're three lanes off the rail, you're four lanes off the rail, excuse me, then you have to beat the eventual Horse of the Year, Curlin, and you're doing it basically going an extra, I don't know, 250 feet longer than Curlin had to do it. So, I mean, everything about the Belmont is why the race has such mystique, and it's why if you're going to win the Triple Crown, this is the ultimate test in which to do it.
The only horse that's required to run all three to win the Triple Crown is the one that's won the Kentucky Derby and the Preakness. You can have entries that haven't entered in any of them, or you can have some that go to the Derby and then come back for the Belmont. So where are the threats in this race?
I've narrowed it down to about two or three. Hoffberg, you mentioned horses that ran in the Derby but didn't run in the Preakness.
Right.
Hoffberg ran well, I thought, in the Derby. I know his running line doesn't show it. He ran seventh that day. But he made up ground. He finished pretty decently. He came into the stretch 17 lengths off the lead, ended up only getting beat nine, or a little bit less than nine lengths. So he ran well. The Belmont trainee is bred perfectly for it. Touch Gold is a Belmont winner. Tappet is an amazing racehorse. And I mentioned, you know, Pulpit, obviously, another top quality racehorse. So the breeding is there. It's Bill Mott. He loves training at Belmont Park. Irad Ortiz getting back on board. This is a horse who I thought had an outside look at the Kentucky Derby itself. He'll be fresh. He'll be ready to fire a big shot. You mentioned a horse that didn't run in any of these races. Number 10, Blended Citizen on the far outside. I liked his win over in the Peter Pan Stakes. That was a few weeks ago at Belmont Park. He avoided some of the rigors of the Triple Crown races itself. He was off the board two starts back in the Bluegrass, but he ran well when he won the JR Stakes race at Turfway Park a couple of races back. And he has something in common, and he has something here that no other horse has. Wins on traditional dirt, synthetic dirt, which they run on in some tracks around America, yep, and on turf. So he's very versatile. And I give him a little bit of a look to at least be, you know, somewhat in the money here a little bit. And then, of course, you know, there's the two Todd Pletcher-trained horses. I prefer Noble Indy a little bit more than maybe I prefer Vino Rosso. I thought Vino Rosso really, really took a step backwards in the Derby last time out.
Yeah.
Noble Indy, I liked his win in a Derby a couple of starts back. I think he'll run better.
Mike Smith, aboard, obviously, on Justify. What does it mean in this race to have an experienced hand like that aboard?
I think it means enough. I don't think you have to overthink this race, especially if you're Mike Smith. You have one responsibility. Don't let anyone get too far out in front of you. That was the deal in the Preakness Stakes when he dealt with Good Magic. So, I mean, yes, it matters. Experience matters in these situations, and especially in big money races. Mike Smith has won the Breeders' Cup Classic several times. He's won the Derby now twice. So I think experience matters, but, I mean, you couldn't have given him a better path from that rail position. Just don't get bumped. Stay in contention. Be close. Don't overthink it. That's one of the things I think that experience plays into factor here is the overthinking factor. And I think you can get caught up in it sometimes, and hopefully Mike Smith won't let that happen to him.
This track is, you know, we mentioned the mile and a half part of it, and it's not just the long, like, stretch run. This is the long back stretch. I mean,
yeah,
you're in a long backstretch, and not only that, but then you've got to make that. It seems like that turn takes forever on this track.
Yeah, and the first turn doesn't seem that long, and then to your point, you mentioned that long backstretch, and it takes forever. And then it's that wide sweeping turn as they come out of that to go into the stretch run. And it's grueling. And again, it's all about timing. And if you're Mike Smith, you know, he gets the benefit of being able to watch a lot of the races earlier in the card. He'll get to figure out where the lane is that you want to be. If you go back to the Preakness Stakes, it was fun watching when Good Magic and his rider tried to float Justify out to the center path to put him into a bad part, a deeper, slower part of the racetrack. And Mike Smith was having none of that. Mike Smith got a head back in front of Good Magic and curved over right back over to the inside. Mike Smith gets to do that. He's going to have all day pretty much to kind of figure out where the lanes are, where the best part of the track is, especially if it comes up a little bit wet. It could be a very fast track if the rains stay away, and that could very clearly benefit Justify, who got the better part of the racetrack. And again, his two best speed figures came over dry tracks at Santa Anita earlier this year.
Steve, how do you want to play it on Saturday? What's your initial read?
Well, okay, so let me just say for the record, I think Justify is going to win the Belmont. I think he's going to win the Triple Crown, and I think he's going to go down in history as one of the five or six greatest Triple Crown winners the world has ever seen. So, that being said, get a souvenir ticket, and you're going to get 10 cents on the dollar.
Right.
So it's not a race you're going to bet on in terms of making money on Justify. But if you want to make some money, I would play at Exacta, keying Justify over the 4-horse Hofburg, the 9-horse Noble Indy, and the 10-horse Blended Citizen. I think those are tickets that can make a couple of dollars. But for me, as far as playing the race is concerned, if you're going to be out there at a racetrack, if you're going to be at Penn National, if you're going to be at any of the racetracks or casinos close by, play pick threes, play pick fours, and single Justify, and enjoy watching history, because I really do believe that we're seeing one of the better Triple Crown winners of all time. And I know that sounds like sacrilege to people who remember American Pharoah from a few years ago. The reason we overhyped American Pharoah in my mind was because it had been so long. It had been 37 years. We would have taken you or me winning the Triple Crown, and it would have gone down in history. We overrated, I think, American Pharoah a little bit. I'm not discounting what he did. I'm not discounting what a great horse he was. Mm-hmm. Justify, in my mind, is even better than him. And he's going to go down as one of the five greatest Triple Crown winners I think the world has ever seen.
Yeah, it was 25 years between Citation and Secretariat, but Secretariat was legitimately great. But then 37 years, that's the biggest gap. I mean, American Pharoah is going to ride that forever because of
that's going to be his place in history. Yeah. But I think the idea that we waited so long kind of overemphasized, over-romanticized, if you will, a little bit, American Pharoah. If you want to watch a truly, truly, truly great racehorse, I think Saturday you're going to see a coronation. I mean, I'm not saying it's going to be Secretary at 31 lengths.
Right.
It might be Affirmed and Alidar, where they come right down to the wire. It could be something like that. But we loved Affirmed and Alidar because it was three great races between these two racehorses who were never more than a half length apart. Justify's going to work for this, but it's going to be to the benefit of racing fans everywhere, because I think it's going to be a spectacle.
Steve, fun as always. Thanks, my friend. Appreciate your insight and also having you on the air with us.
Anytime, my friends. Have a great day.
Steve Bornstein joining us, Fox Sports Louisville. We'll come back with more in a moment. Still to come, we'll have Sean Leahy will join us from Las Vegas. It's a dry heat, by the way, as we continue on News Radio 1070 WKOK. All right, great to have you with us on the show today. We'll talk about the Stanley Cup in the final half hour. The Warriors take on the Cavaliers tonight. The bottom line is Golden State is better. You can do all the LeBron stuff and this, that, and the other thing, whatever. You know, what does he need to do? Look, they're just better. They have more players. Now, playing at home is going to help them tonight. Tonight's the line in the sand game. But the bottom line is the Cavaliers are not good enough defensively. They're just not. They have not been a good defensive team all year. This is not a case of, well, now they're facing really good teams, so because they're facing really good teams that have strong offensive players, no. They have been a mediocre defensive team all season. You don't end up 29th in defense in a 30-team league unless you're not great at it. They need to hold Golden State consistently under 100 points to have a chance to win. If Golden State cracks 100 points, then I don't think Cleveland has a chance. They don't. Now, I may come back here on Friday and the final was 108-106. They're like, yeah, what do you know? That's right. That's why we have the show. But that's the bottom line. They talk about adjustments that have to be made, and they have to make more threes, and maybe Kyle Korver needs to play more. Well, Kyle Korver does need to play more. Yeah. Is Kyle Korver a good defensive player? No. But there are moments you have to sacrifice some of that to get the element into the game you need. And I know they need to be better defensively, but they also need him to shoot the ball. Just get him out there, shoot, and then compensate for it. This is where It's interesting, in the days gone by, you don't hear much talk about this stuff anymore, and I'm wondering what the coaches' roles are in these things, or whether they're just not good enough like coaches in days gone by. When the Celtics played the Lakers, they constantly were talking Casey Jones, Pat Riley, all the time about the adjustment they have to make between games. Well, where's the talk about adjustments? Okay, let's talk adjustments. Let's talk defensive adjustments. Where have those questions been? Instead, we're getting, so what's the mindset of J.R. Smith? I don't know. I mean, let's get to the game. I don't know. Ask J.R. Smith. But there should be a lot of questions about where are the Cavaliers not adjusting defensively, because the Cavaliers' defensive performance in Game 2 was no better than mediocre. I thought they hung in there defensively decently in Game 1, but Game 2, defense was a no-show. And that's been a problem for Cleveland all season. This is not something that just cropped up. Where are the questions about adjustments? Where? I mean, in the 80s, they asked those questions, but maybe that's because those coaches adjusted. I don't know. Then again, they had the personnel to adjust. All right, final half hour, Sean Leahy, NBCSports.com from Las Vegas.
Three deals are neck and neck as they come down to the finish line. And they're all tied at $20,850. Looks like at SMC, everyone's a winner.
It's the Sunbury Motors Ford Triple Crown of Savings. SMC needs to get out of the gate fast in June so you can pick from 13 2018 Ford Fusions starting at $20,850. Choose from 67 2018 Ford Escapes as low as $20,850. Or the all-new, hot-selling 2018 Ford EcoSport 4x4 slash to $20,850. But that's not all. Pick from over 85 2018 Ford F-150s with savings up to $12,500 off. And they start as low as $26,669 plus 0% financing for up to 72 months on select models. At SMC, these fantastic deals are justified. The Triple Crown sale won't last long, so hurry into Sunbury Motors in the North 4th Street Auto Plaza, Sunbury. SMC, satisfying more customers and selling more cars since 1915.
Taking your calls at 800-795-9565. This is the Steve Jones Show on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Now from the Sunbury Motors Studio, here's Steve Jones.
Sunbury Motors, 4th Street in Sunbury. Sunbury Motors, Key Routes 11 and 15 in Hummel's Wharf. 74 years ago today was D-Day. The invasion of Europe. Saved a continent, saved the world. And 50 years ago today, Bobby Kennedy passed away. I was in fourth grade at the time, 10 years old. I remember waking up on the 5th of June and hearing the news before I went to school that day that he had been shot. And then all day on the 5th, hearing that he was alive, but I remember also hearing reports that like he'd been shot in the head, and they were wondering what kind of life would he have, would he make it? And this, of course, happened just 2 months after Dr. King had been killed, and you know, I'm sitting there, we had to line up outside of our school to go in fourth grade. I remember kids talking in line about what was going to happen next, because nobody knew. 1968 was a very hard year in this country, and I remember living through it. Remember we had Denny McLean on the show a couple, 3 years ago?
That's right.
And he won 31 games, and he said, look, he said, I'll be honest with you. He says, us winning the World Series that year, or being in contention to win it all summer, he says, actually calmed Detroit down. Actually brought people together, he says, because we were winning, so people were paying attention to us. It helped. All right, Las Vegas, first time through as a professional city, and they've got a team in the Stanley Cup final, but they're down 3-1. It's 117 in Las Vegas right now. But as Sean Leahy can testify to from NBCSports.com, it is a dry heat. Sean, welcome.
Hey, how are you?
Doing very well. I'm going to assume you're inside.
Yes, I'm inside the Golden Knights' beautiful practice facility out in Summerlin, where it is a nice cool breeze from the air conditioning and from the refrigeration pumps pumping in that cold air to keep the ice nice and cold. So I'm glad to be inside and not melting my pasty Irish skin outside.
Sean, I want to get to the Capitals' penalty kill because I have felt it has been ultra aggressive. They have almost, to me, attacked the Vegas power play. Has that been emblematic of how they've played the entire series since game one?
Oh, yeah. I mean, basically, Barry Trotz has continually brought this up throughout this series, and even through these playoffs, where his team has an all-in mentality. This is not the best Capitals team of this Ovechkin and Backstrom era, but this team, they've bought into what Barry Trotz has sold them, and you can just see that on the penalty kill, even at 5-on-5. Guys are blocking shots left and right. They're getting sticks and passing lanes. They're not screening their own goaltender, so Braden Holtby hasn't really had to make any kind of crazy saves, kind of like what Marc-Andre Fleury had to do back in Game 3. Alex Ovechkin dropping down a block shot, which is something you probably never thought you'd ever see. But this team is just committed to winning, and certainly even though they lost Game 1, there was a lot of confidence to take out of Game 1 because they were able to beat Marc-Andre Fleury. They played well enough, and then obviously we've seen what happened over the last 3 games where the series is really dying.
What has John Carlson meant to what they're doing?
He's invaluable. He's the number one defenseman. He can eat those heavy minutes. Perpetuation certainly has a bomb from the point, but he's a guy too. Everyone talks about Ovechkin and Backstrom, but he's a guy who's been through a lot of those ups and downs that this franchise has been through, so he knows just how special this run is, and it's hard to replace a guy like that, and they're going to find out potentially this summer because he's going to be a free agent and probably going to make a lot of money somewhere, whether it's the Capitals or somewhere else, just because he can provide some offense. He's great defensively. He's in the North Shore conversation for a little bit of part of this season. So he's just really grown into a dependable guy. You're definitely an elite number one defenseman on any team for sure.
I realize the last 31 finals that have been 3-1 have all been won by the team up 3-1. But give me the Vegas side of it. You know, I mean, it's not over. So they're at home coming up tomorrow night. What's the Vegas side of this?
Well, I mean, look, everyone's doubted this team from the beginning, right? And they've answered every single question and surprised a lot of people to get to where they are right now. So being down 3-1, if you're Vegas, you have no pressure, right? Even though you're playing at home tomorrow night, everyone's expecting the Capitals to close this out just by looking at what's happened over the last 3 games. So hopefully Gerard Gallant can tell his guys just there's no pressure on you. Play loose. Play what we've done. You know, go back to what's worked this season. And we've seen in most of these games where Vegas comes out very strong in the first 5-10 minutes, and more often than not, they've gotten that first goal. And they came out strong last game. You know, unfortunately for them, they didn't get that first goal, and things kind of snowballed from there. But you know, we see how well they play at home, using that energy from the crazy crowd at T-Mobile Arena. So all the pressure's on the Capitals, especially, you know, we all know the Capitals' history, being up 3-1 in series and collapsing many, many times. So Vegas just has to try and play loose and pressure-free.
When you look at how Vegas has played over the season, speed has been a big plus for them. Has Washington-style play negated some of that speed?
Yeah, what's helped Vegas throughout the season into the playoffs was their ability to, you know, transition quickly, use speed through the neutral zone, and set up shop in the offensive zone. But this series of Capitals, they structure things. They really breaks up the speed that the Golden Knights can try and, you know, trying to pick up and get through the neutral zone and get a clean zone entry. They haven't been able to do that. And when they've been able to get into the offensive zone, more often than not, and this is something Gerard Gallant's pointed out a couple of times in the series, they've been one and done. They've gotten one shot attempt, and all of a sudden the Capitals are transitioning up ice and counterattacking. For as aggressive as the Golden Knights have played, sometimes those result in an odd man rush. So They're going to get their last line change tomorrow night, being at the home team. So Gerard Gallant's going to get his favorable matchups out there and want to get his guys going. But there's a lot that the Golden Knights need to do to really get back in this series. It's certainly to find a way to get back to their speed game and certainly also get production from guys not on their fourth line or defense, because I believe it's 6 of their 11 goals in this series have come from a fourth line or one of their defensemen. So you need guys like Marc Gessault to step up, Eric Hall, James Neal, guys like that, if they're going to have any chance to make a comeback here.
They put Thomas Tatar back in the lineup. He's had success against Holpe before. And he's obviously been around the block of this thing before, too. What can he add?
Well, he certainly has a different dimension, some speed, maybe a little bit more skill than David Perron. And he's a guy who is, they paid a big price from at the trade deadline, gave him like 3 picks. And then he was watching a lot of the games in the playoffs because he's sitting up in the press box, and then gets a chance in the Winnipeg series to score a goal during a big win early on in that series. So, he's a guy who can definitely bring you some offensive skill in that second or third line, depending on where you slot him. So he wasn't really too noticeable the other night, but I guess the game kind of got out of hand there after a little bit there, so the Knights' game plan changed. But he's a guy that you want production from. You want production from him, from Hall, from Neal, from all your top guys need to start showing up. And that's a big reason why the Knights got as far as they have so far, and they're going to need those guys to step up to win tomorrow night and beyond.
Holpe was the difference in the end against Pittsburgh. He shut out Tampa Bay the final two games of their series. The last few games he's been fabulous. But going into the series, the story was Marc-Andre Fleury. Has Fleury played well, in your opinion, or has Fleury played to maybe a step down from the level he played most of the season?
It's definitely a little bit of a step down. I mean, he was beyond any doubt, the Conn Smythe favorite heading into the series, and now he's really off the radar. He had, a great game three. In the Knights in the game. Highlight reel saves he had to make in that game, but you still want to see him revert back. He's sometimes in the playoffs, your top guys are getting shut down, like the Knights have throughout the series. You need your goaltender to steal you one of those 1-0, 2-1 games, and unfortunately, he's trying. But the Capitals are doing a good job of making him move around the crease. And also, most importantly, what the Capitals are doing much better than the Knights are is they're getting traffic to Fleury. They're getting screens, they're creating chaos in front of his net, getting those rebounds. Remember that Alex Ovechkin diving goal earlier in the series? But goals like that, Capitals are getting, whereas the Knights aren't able to do that in front of the Holpe crease because they're getting one-shot attempts and they're unable to generate any sort of rebound or secondary chances.
What's the attitude in the city? Here it is. It's the return. So in the return, what's the attitude like there?
There's still some hope. This is certainly, to use an old gambling cliche, they've been playing with house money these playoffs, right? You don't expect them to get this.
That's true.
To do all this, and here they are, Stanley Cup final in year one, and this is gravy. This is fantastic. This is a season to build on, to build the foundation for this franchise going forward 5, 10, 20 years from now. But certainly they're confident. They love their team. I'm speaking to you guys right outside of the practice rink, and there's a line that I can't even see where it ends for people waiting to get in line to get into watch practice. Now, I don't know if you ever attended a hockey practice before, but they're pretty boring.
Yes, they are.
The stands have been filled for every practice they've had here. The city has grown and fall in love with this team, and the team is reciprocated, obviously, with winning and doing all the things they've done in the community, obviously, since the October 1st tragedy. So it's been a great first year, and win or lose, the fans can't be more in love with this team right now, no matter what happens.
Yeah, they were a unifying force after Mandalay Bay. There's no question about that. In talking to your colleagues about covering the series that includes Vegas. Washington's a given entity. Everybody knows that. How impressed have they been by just the fact that not only has it been embraced, but do they think it's been good for the league?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, just think of all the PR the league has gotten from just an expansion team making to the final, an expansion team in Las Vegas making to the final. You know, just the atmosphere in T-Mobile Arena for the two games so far has been unbelievable. Even during warmups, the stands are packed. They have showgirls around the edge of the lower bowl behind the Capitol net. Yeah. It's really like a party for each game, and the fans just they play off for that, and it's such a great atmosphere. It's loud. The nice marketing department and I really found a way to perfectly market this team and showcase this team, not just the people of Las Vegas, but people outside of Las Vegas, people like myself who are coming to watch a game for the first time, have never had that experience, and, you know, we're sold. I mean, you just see, like I said, you see the fans coming to the practices, you see them coming to the games, the atmosphere outside the arena before games. It's electric, and it's certainly, like I said before, this season has been something for this franchise to build on. No one expected this before, and I'm curious to see just kind of how this alters George McPhee and Bill Foley's original plan as far as building this team into a perennial contender.
Well, it's a dry heat at 117. When practice is over, go lay on the ice. Okay?
That's the plan. It's just like a dog in the kitchen.
All right. Thanks so much. Appreciate it, Sean. Enjoy it out there.
All right, guys. Take care.
Sean Leahy, NBCSports.com. We'll wrap it up in a moment on News Radio 1070 WKOK. Okay, welcome back. Warriors and Cavaliers tonight. So we'll get into it. And again, look, the bottom line is Golden State's the better team. Kyrie Irving plays, the Celtics are the better team than the Cavaliers. If they play Gordon Hayward and Kyrie Irving, they're definitely the better team. The bottom line is that the Cavaliers at full strength versus Golden State or Boston or Houston, okay, they're the fourth best team in the league. And to be frank with you, I'm kind of wondering in some way if they're on another team that might be better than they are at full strength.
There was one quote that I saw in regards to defending Golden State. It's like you're in a boat with three holes in the bottom and you only have two pegs to plug them, and you keep moving the pegs around. Especially when you got Steph, and it doesn't matter where he's at outside the three-point arc, whether it's, you know, Kevin Love or someone else defending, or even if it's Klay Thompson, if they can just buckle down a little more, it just seems like they're giving them just way too much air when they put up those three-point shots.
It's just their defense is just, it's just not good, Sean. It's just not. When J.R. Smith is perceived to be as being a better defender than Kyle Korver, okay, we're going with our best defensive option. Oh, that's your best defensive option? Brutal. I mean, that's brutal. That's a problem. That's why you have a problem. You have a problem because of that. You're looking around saying, that's our best defensive option. Really? And I think Tristan Thompson, by the way, is a good defensive player. Kevin Love is no better than okay. We know Korver struggles. George Hill's okay. Clarkson, I mean, we could go to a playground now in Selins Grove. I mean, Clarkson would just like, okay, you know. Clarkson, to his credit, understands that he's only playing defense until they go on offense again. It's brutal. Oh, well.
The one thing I noticed about a week or so ago, the night that Cleveland finally qualified for the NBA Finals, when they were all walking to the trophy presentation, and when you saw LeBron James walk past Dan Gilbert. There was no eye contact. There was no fist bump, no high five, nothing like that. So it just makes you wonder in the back of LeBron's mind when he made the announcement a few years ago he was coming back to Cleveland. I wonder if Mr. Gilbert was going to get us the right pieces in place and the right players that we can win more multiple titles. Whereas now, you're staring at the bottom of the barrel of elimination 2 games from now. You could be, you know, seeing the other team lifting up the Larry O'Brien trophy on your floor.
Yeah, but what was the impetus for trading Kyrie Irving? They had it in place. What's the impetus for trading Kyrie Irving? Was the impetus that Irving absolutely wanted out, wouldn't play? Was the impetus Dan Gilbert and whatever trying to make some sort of deal, thinking, hey, long term is what we do? Or was LeBron an issue? They had that. They had one of the top 10 players in the league with LeBron already. They freely dealt him. Why? For Isaiah Thomas. I remember my son calling, my son Dan calling me up and saying, hey, can you believe the Celtics got Kyrie Irving? I said, what do you mean they got Kyrie Irving? I said, how'd they do that? So they gave him Isaiah Thomas and, you know, and Jay Crowder and whatnot. I'm like, I said, really? Hey, that's the lunacy of this whole thing. You watch the first year the Cavaliers met up with the Warriors. Kyrie Irving dominated the first game and a half and then got hurt. I mean, I'm talking dominated. I mean, he made Steph Curry look silly. Then the second year, Kyrie had a great final, played all the way through. They won. They had that guy. Why did they trade him away? Was it Dan Gilbert? Was it Kyrie's wish? Or was it one of those that kind of came together and LeBron said, okay, go ahead?
I would have thought it was Kyrie's wish to be, you know, bigger fish on another team, to be the man on another team.
But he's under contract.
Yeah.
He's under contract.
But I just wonder after that move, in the back of LeBron's mind, okay, yeah, I'm going to give maximum effort, but it just makes you wonder. And obviously, you know, he has the right to make the decision and do whatever he wants, and he'll have to consult with his wife, sure, because, you know, they love the Cleveland and Akron area. But just makes you wonder, after that happened, yeah, I'm going to ride this out, and then I'm going to maybe go to L.A., since he has, what, two $20 million homes there? See if he can get an offer from Houston. Who knows?
I don't know. The whole thing makes no sense.
No.
They had that guy in place. I mean, you don't sit there and freely break up a big three. When you got a big three, you don't freely break it up. Now they spent the trade deadline scrambling to somehow fix it. I can assure you, no uncertain terms. Let's see. Who would Steph Curry rather face? Kyrie Irving or George Hill? Man. I'm not saying Kyrie Irving's the second coming, but he's one of the top 10 to 15 players in the game. The Celtics ended up being a number 2 seed in part because of what he did, averaging 24.5 points and 7 assists per game this season. The Warriors are just flat out better.
You're listening to News Radio 1070 WKOK Sunbury. You can hear us anywhere in the world with the Sunbury Broadcasting Corporation app.